Well, the text for these three studies that orient us in a generous life are the words that St. John gives. I have come that they may have life and have it abundantly. Not a skimpy life, not just getting by on starvation rations. Abundant, generous. And I'm anchoring each address in a pivotal event in Jesus' life. This morning, his birth. Now, his death. And tomorrow, it'll be his resurrection. And I might just say that this is comprehensive. We've got to have a whole gospel if we're going to have a convincing gospel. We can't just take parts and pieces and things and use them to do something. This is big. This is just huge. And it takes a long time to get our imaginations even just partially adequate to what's going on. So I hope I can help create that sense of a comprehensive and reverent, faithful imagination as you do your work from your pulpits and your lecterns. Everything in the Christian life finds its place in and around this tripod framework of Jesus' birth, death, and resurrection. Not in a general truth, but personal, a personal revelation in the conditions of our humanity. Not something out of a Mars spaceship. The moment we leave this personal relational structure, we leave the gospel and find ourselves putting together a makeshift do-it-yourself shack with no elbow room. What we're after is a rich immersion of our imaginations in the lived quality of what God has revealed in Jesus as the broad and capacious life that includes our creation, our salvation, and our communities. Nothing we do or think or feel or experience can maintain its gospel dimensions, which means this huge good news dimension. It's characteristic good news tone without this orientation. No doctrine, no ethic, no practice. If at any time we reduce the gospel to an impersonal idea or doctrine or shrink it into an individualistic private practice, we end up with a meager, shabby, patchwork, out at the elbows, hand-me-down parody of what Jesus intends for all men and women. So I'm particularly interested in setting this fundamental generosity of the Christian life in the biblical setting of generosity. God's generosity, not ours. This morning we took a look around the neighborhood of creation. We were struck, or at least I was, by the sheer profusion of life. A rose in blossom, a red-tailed hawk in flight, a cat on the prowl, white oak and blue whale, amoeba and giraffe. All these give fresh and eloquent witness to a mystery that ever eludes us, but never, if we take time for it, fails to put us on our knees in adoration. And this is especially true of human life. Every time a baby is born, the good news of creation is preached. The virgin birth of Jesus provides the centering pulpit for preaching this entire world of experience in which we receive the revelation of God as Christ plays in creation. But we're not on our knees very long, taking in the wonder of creation, before we find out that not everything is so wonderful. Mosquitoes invade our picnic. A patch of black ice sends our car careening off a winter wonderland road into a ditch. And our carefully tended garden is trashed by the neighbor's joyful Dalmatian. And we're not up on our feet very long, alive with an awareness of our participation, resurrection eager, ready to love, before we find out that not everybody thinks the human life is so wonderful. The lovely baby cries, gets sick, interrupts our sleep, invades our comfortable routines, and then begins to grow and turns into a disobedient, defiant brat. He refuses to eat what we prepared for supper, She leaves her room a mess, and it's not long before we're having headaches and sleepless nights over this child that not long ago, we were cuddling in our arms. If the world is so wonderful, why all this trouble, this mess? We pick up this lovely apple, bite into it, and find that there is a worm in the apple. This is the world of experience in which we receive the revelation of God as Christ plays in history. We have a glorious beginning, but things took a bad turn long before we entered, and it isn't long before we find that we're living with the consequences of catastrophe. Much of life, much of our lives, consists in picking up the pieces of history, cleaning up the mess. Popular American forms of spirituality tend to avoid history as the subject matter and context for nurturing the soul, particularly the messier aspects of history as reported in the media and experienced in our congregations. We leave that for politicians and social workers and the police to take care of that. The sensory-rich outside world of mountains and seashores and the inner world of thoughts and emotions enhanced by poetry, song, and meditation are more congenial. But I want to bring us into history, not as spectators or predictors of doomsday, but as participants. History is bounded by birth and new birth, by the virgin birth of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus, life, life, and more life. But between these two life-giving moments, there's also death, death, and more death. When we are born, we find ourselves in a world in which death and dying are major preoccupations. When we are born again, it is still the same world. History consists of what happens in this world. History is the accounting we make of human endeavor. More often than not, it's an accounting of the mess we make of things. Brutality, war, famine, hate, quarreling, exploitation. History deals with what happens, what has happened, what is happening, and what will happen. It means dealing with a world where things rarely turn out the way we think they should. It means dealing with corrupt politicians, birth defects, floods and volcanoes, divorce and death, the arrogance of the rich and the destitution of the poor. It has to do with dealing with your congregation 3 months after the honeymoon. The most conspicuous event in history that arouses within us the spontaneous sense of violation of outrageous sacrilege is the suffering and death of Jesus. A suffering and death in which eventually we will find ourselves involved, whether we like it or not, history. And because of the death of Jesus, the most conspicuous event in history is salvation, our salvation. We don't enter into salvation by escaping from death, but by embracing it, just as Jesus did. I had a delayed but abrupt introduction to the mess of history. I grew up in a Christian home with good parents. I was told the story of Jesus, instructed in the right way to live. I was loved and treated well. In my memory, it was a fair approximation of the Garden of Eden, a good and wonderful creation. Our modest house was on a gravel road on the edge of a small Montana town, 3 or 4 blocks beyond where the sidewalks ended. It was a neighborhood with plenty of playmates, none of whom went to church, but their unbaptized state never seemed to make any difference in the preschool life of games, kick the can, hide and seek, softball, and imagination, pretending to be explorers like Lewis and Clark, Indians like Chief Joseph and Sacagawea. There were trees to climb and a creek to swim in. There was a meadow bordering our backyard on which cows grazed. We used dry cow flop for a basis in our ball games. And then I went to school and discovered what St. John named the world. A society that does not regard God with either reverence or obedience. This knowledge came into my life into the person of Garrison Johns. Garrison was a year older than me and the school bully. He lived in a log house a couple of hundred yards beyond where I lived, the yard littered with rusted out trucks and cars. I'd been in that house only once. It was a cold winter day, and his mother, a beautiful, willowy woman as I remember her, invited me and the Mitchell twins in to warm up with a bowl of moose meat chili that was simmering on the back of the wood stove. Struggling through deep snow, we were taking a shortcut home through her backyard. We must have looked half frozen. We were half frozen. And she had compassion on us. But Garrison wasn't there. I'd never seen him close up, only at a distance. He wore a red flannel shirt summer and winter, walked with something of a swagger that I admired and tried to imitate. Being a year older than me and living just far enough away, he was beyond the orbit of my neighborhood games and friendships. I knew of his reputation for meanness, but the memory of his mother's kindness tempered my apprehension. I wasn't prepared for what was to come. About the third day in school, Garrison discovered me, took me on as his project for the year, and gave me a historical knowledge, working knowledge, of what was wrong with the world. I had been taught in Sunday school not to fight, and so I'd never learned to use my fists. I'd been prepared for the wider world of what's wrong with the world by memorizing, "Bless those who persecute you and turn the other cheek." I don't know how Garrison knew that about me, but some sixth sense that bullies have, I think. But about the third day of school, he picked me for his sport. Most afternoons after school, he would catch me and beat me up. He also found out that I was a Christian and taunted me with "Jesus, sissy." I tried finding alternate ways home by making detours to alleys, but he stalked me and always found me out. I arrived home every afternoon bruised and humiliated. My mother told me that this had always been the way of Christians in the world and I had better get used to it. I was also supposed to pray for him. The Bible verses that I had memorized, "bless" and "turn," began to get tiresome. I loved going to school, learning so much, finding new friends, adoring my teachers. The classroom was a wonderful place. But soon after the dismissal bell each day, I had to face Garrison Johns and get the daily beating that I was trying my best to assimilate as my blessing. March came. I remember it was March because of the weather. The winter snow was melting, but there were still patches of snow here and there. The days were getting longer. I was no longer walking home in the late afternoon dark. And then one day, something unexpected happened. I was with my neighborhood friends, seven or eight of them, when Garrison caught up with us and started in on me, jabbing and taunting, working himself up to the main event. He had an audience, and that provided extra incentive. He always did better with an audience. And that's when it happened. Something snapped within me, totally uncalculated, totally out of character. For just a moment, the Bible verses disappeared from my consciousness, and I grabbed Garrison. To my surprise and his, I realized that I was stronger than he. I wrestled him to the ground, sat on his chest, pinned his arms to the ground with my knees. I couldn't believe it. He was helpless under me, at my mercy. It was too good to be true. I hit him in the face with my fists. It felt good. I hit him again. Blood spurted from his nose, a lovely crimson on the snow. By this time, all the other children were cheering, egging me on. Black his eyes, bust his teeth. A torrent of vengeful invective poured from them, although nothing compared with what I would later in my life read in the Psalms. I said to Garrison, "Say uncle." He wouldn't say it. I hit him again. More blood. More cheering. Now the audience was bringing the best out of me. And then my Christian training reasserted itself. I said, "Say, I believe in Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior." And you said it. Garrison Johns was my first Christian convert. Garrison Johns was my introduction to the world that is not my home. Creation is wonderful, but history is a mess. It was also my introduction into how effortlessly this same world could get into me, making itself at home under the cover of my Christian language and righteous emotions. Well, that happened 76 years ago. I have since moved back and taken up residence once more in this Montana valley in which I grew up. Was beaten up by Garrison Johns almost daily for 7 months, and on that March afternoon in 1940, I think, bloodied his nose and obtained his Christian confession. A few years ago, I drove down the street where the evangelistic event took place and pointed out the spot to my wife. When I got home, I thought, I wonder what's become of Garrison Johns. I located him about 10 miles from my present home in the telephone book, and sure enough, his name was listed. Should I call him up? Would he remember? Is he still a bully? Did the ill-gotten Christian confession take? What would a meeting result in a personal preview of Armageddon in which I would end up on the losing side? I didn't call him up, put off the judgment. I need to tell you this. I tell that story in my memoir, The Pastor, and I was invited to an Episcopal church just across the lake from where I live to talk about my book. Somebody asked a question, whatever happened to Garrison Johns? And Garrison Johns is not his real name. And I said, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if he's still living. And then I used his real name. And afterwards, a woman came up and she said, he died. He lived here in the community. He died just about 6 months ago. And he was still a Christian. He was very devout. So I have another star in my crown. Meanwhile, I continue to reflect on what it means to be plunged into history. God made everything good, but in that good creation, soon or late, each one of us, one after another, gets discovered by Garrison Johns and finds that not everyone thinks that our place in this creation is so wonderful. We are plunged into pain and disappointment and suffering. Sometimes it recedes for a while. Other times it threatens to overwhelm us. Sometimes it seems like it will never quit. And the final verdict on all this is death. We die. Strangely, virtually every death, even of the very old, feels like an intrusion and more or less surprises us. Tears and lament give witness to our basic sense that this is wrong and we don't like it one bit. Death provides the fundamental datum that something isn't working out the way it was intended, accompanied by the feeling that we have a right to expect something other and better. Well, the birth of Jesus provides our entrance into the reality and meaning of creation, this world of the Father revealed by Jesus. Jesus shows that the creation is something to be lived, not just believed, but just looked at, but in the way he did it becomes the way we do it. In a parallel way, the death of Jesus provides our entrance into the reality and responsibilities of history. Mostly, but not always, it's a mess. The daily round of failed plans, disappointed relations, political despair, accidents and sickness and neighborhood bullies, it's the same mess of history in which we find ourselves and in which Jesus found himself. The remarkable thing is that Jesus embraced it. This embrace involved him in enormous suffering and an excruciating death. The life of Jesus is not a happy story, not a success story. What it is, and we're coming to this, is a salvation story. And this is what's so important right now, I think, to get through our heads. His birth precipitated a bloody massacre of babies. His entrance into public ministry plunged him into a 40-day wilderness ordeal in which he went to the mat with evil, tested to the limit of body and soul. At the moment of what seemed to be a breakthrough understanding of his messianic identity among the disciples at Caesarea Philippi, Jesus' lead disciple, Peter, turned out to have more affinity for Satan than for his master. And when Jesus was surrounded with acclaim of hosannas in the great Passover parade into Jerusalem, certainly a moment of festive celebration if there ever was one, Jesus wept. He wept for the suffering of body and the pain of soul in store for these men and women and children who are having such an innocently good time. History is lubricated by tears. Prayer, maybe most prayer, two-thirds of the Psalms are laments, is accompanied by tears. All these tears are gathered up and absorbed in the tears of Jesus. The death of Jesus outside Jerusalem under Pontius Pilate, the date, according to our calendars, is AD 30, placed in the large context of his birth, resurrection, and ascension, is essentially the gospel proclamation. Jesus' death becomes the event that defines our salvation as accomplished, a done deal. This death does not come out of the blue. It's the final entry in a long history of suffering and death that is embraced and prayed in our scriptures. Jesus was born into a people of God that had a long and still living tradition of taking history seriously as the arena in which God carries out his work of salvation. A deeply pervasive sense of history, the dignity of their place in history, accounts for a large part in which the ways in which the Hebrew people talked and wrote. And this was unusual, almost, I think, unique. They did not, as was the fashion in the ancient world, make up and embellish fanciful stories. Their writings did not entertain or explain. They revealed the way of God with men and women in the world. They gave narrative shape to actual people and circumstances in their dealings with God and in God's dealings with them. For the prophets and priests and writers who preceded Jesus and in whose footsteps Jesus continued, there was no secular history, none. Everything that happened, happened in a world penetrated by God. The Hebrew people were intent on observing and participating in what happened in and around them because they believed that God was personally alive in the world, in their community, and in them. Life could not be accounted for by something less than the life of God, no matter how impressive and mysterious that was, whether an eclipse of the sun, like their pagan neighbors, spots on the liver of a goat, or the hiss of steam from a fissure in the earth. God could not be reduced to astronomical, physiological, geological, or psychological phenomena. God was alive always and everywhere, working his will, challenging people with his call, evoking faith and obedience, calling them into a worshiping community, showing his love and compassion, working out judgments on sin. And none of this in general or at large, but at particular times, in specific places, with named persons, history. If creation provides the setting for grasping life, the incredible variety and boundlessness and generosity of life, history provides the setting for taking in the mind-boggling reality of salvation. Salvation is the term that most succinctly takes in the reality accomplished by Jesus in history, and it has its focus in Jesus' death. Ask any biblical writer what history is about, and the answer is salvation. If the phrase had not long ago been reduced to a cliche, Jesus saves would serve admirably as an adequate summary for what our scriptures have to say on the subject. But bumper stickers and graffiti have isolated the phrase so completely that the story, to which it is the punchline, has taken all the meaning, and all the meaning has been drained out of the words. We need to recover the entire salvation story if the words Jesus serve to make anything. Salvation is not a one-night stand. It cannot be isolated from the thick texture of history. Salvation is all-encompassing, pulling everything that has happened and happens and every person named and unnamed into relationship with the work of God in history. I want to recover this salvation generosity that the biblical story conveys. I think it is essential that we rid our imaginations of understandings inappropriate to the reality of the salvation story as it is revealed in our biblical witness. It is far too common to turn save and salvation into abstractions or principles and then fill them out with our fantasies or ideas. What salvation definitely is not is an effort to salvage a few planks and timbers from a wrecked ship. Save and salvation come to us not as isolated words or phrase fragments, but embedded in a large, large story that has a plot and characters and centuries in the development and telling. The energies of salvation send out tentacles into every nook and cranny of history. Salvation is an immense ecological system, surpassing even creation in complexity, in which everything is affected by everything else. And the book of Exodus is the primary orienting place to get a feel for the pattern of God's salvation. Exodus sets the salvation story in Egypt, with the people of God mired in history at its worst. They've been slaves in Egypt for 430 years. Their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick. I want to use the Exodus story, salvation story, to prepare your imaginations to take in its completion in the Jesus salvation story. It's conventional for historians to assemble the achievements of nations and civilizations in order to establish the nature and meaning of their influence in the course of human affairs. Kings and generals are prominent. Buildings and monuments get respectful attention. Language is studied and literary remains carefully assessed. Trade routes with their economic implications are traced. Battles and treaties, floods and famines, all these things leave their mark. Egypt is a showcase for such attention by historians. For over 200 years now, ancient Egypt has come under the delighted and avid scrutiny of archaeologists and philologists. Napoleon Bonaparte kicked off the rediscovery in ancient Egypt in 1798 by sailing from France and challenging the power of England in Egypt. His military campaign failed, but there was an unexpected benefit. He brought scholars and artists with him, and they gathered a rich harvest of ancient documents. Men and women have been searching ever since through the gigantic tombs, temples of Egypt, reading the texts, reconstructing the history of this magnificently impressive, world-dominating civilization. Some of you have been there. The evidence of power and beauty imposed on that desert landscape 3,000 and 4,000 and 5,000 years ago never fails to stagger the imagination. And here's the thing. The biblical writers ignore all of it. They have no interest in the spectacular achievements of men and women. They are not interested in arrogant displays of ego. They are interested in God and know better than to look for signs of his presence and activity in the big, the multitudinous, the in-your-face assertive. They come at history more in the spirit and manner of poet William Meredith. I speak of unremarked forces that split the heart and make the pavement toss, forces concealed in quiet people and plants. And here's something that astonishes me every time I read this story. The first names that appear in the grounding account of God at work in history are Shiphrah and Puah, midwives, slaves from the lowest social and economic strata of that society. The two women defy the order of the Egyptian king to kill all Hebrew babies at birth. By that act of defiance, they set in motion the chain of historical events that eventually set alongside the story of Jesus becomes the paradigmatic account of salvation for all of history. The king of Egypt, also referred to as Pharaoh, which is a title, not a name, perhaps the most powerful world ruler at the time, is not even dignified with a personal name. These two obscure Hebrew slave women are named, and by virtue of being named, are no longer obscure. Shiphrah and Puah. They are midwives. Their job is to bring babies into the world. When the world powerful king orders them to kill these babies, they quietly and without fanfare defy him. We won't forget this. Salvation is not imposed from above or from without. It emerges out of the conditions in which we find ourselves as life is confronted with death. Shiphrah and Puah, working daily at the times and places in which human life breaks out of the womb into history, are defiant of the command to kill babies. The will to life crosses with the command to kill. The command to kill comes from the impersonal anonymity of privilege and power. The will to life comes from the marginal but very personal Shiphrah and Puah, representatives of the oppressed and powerless. History is told from the place of invincibility is mostly about death, as told from the place of vulnerability is mostly about life. World leaders are minor players in the biblical way of writing and participating in history. People like Shiphrah and Puah play the decisive roles. And until we understand this and embrace it, this placing of the action, the primacy of grounding it in the personal and the ordinary, we will never be in a position to participate wholeheartedly in the main action of salvation. And just a footnote, what better place to do this than in the ordinary congregation? Moses and Aaron, who led the people of God through the historical circumstances in which salvation was revealed and experienced, came from the same neighborhood as Shiphrah and Puah, the neighborhood in which babies were under threat of death by the powers that be. If Shiphrah and Puah had done their Pharaoh-commanded work, Moses and Aaron would have been dead on arrival. We know little about Moses and even less about his brother Aaron. What is clear is, like their midwives, they come from the margins of society. Moses enters history rescued from the bulrushes by an Egyptian princess. His murder of the Egyptian bully and escape to Midian. His Samaritan intervention on behalf of Reuel's seven shepherd daughters and later marriage to one of them, Zipporah. Each of these incidents reinforces his outsider position. And as to leadership, he's singularly ill-equipped. He has no confidence, no, as we like to say, self-esteem. Now, what is happening here? We're getting a feel for the circumstances in which salvation is worked out. The essential and primary focus is God. The salvation story is a God story. God doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. It is also God doing it in his own way and not to our dictates and preferences. He does not consult us in matters of timing. And we need constant reminding of this. We humans, with our deep-seated pretension to being gods and endlessly preoccupied with worrying and tinkering with matters of salvation as if we were in charge, but we're not. God carries out God's work in God's way. And now we're at the heart of the story. Egypt represented the ultimate in control, controlling a large slave population, controlling the afterlife with the erection of those great pyramids, controlling a world empire, controlling a huge stable of gods and goddesses, as if by building these huge stone, gigantic, magnificent statues, they could, through their elaborate priestly machinations, control history. But that is anti-history. History is a field for salvation. Dealing with people as objects is a violation of the primary work of history, which is salvation. And reducing God to an object or idea or definition so that we can control God is an outrageous absurdity, no matter how solemnly carried out. and the Egyptians were nothing if not solemn. A major difficulty in embracing history as the field for salvation is the sheer mass of relentless and assertive counter-evidence. The loudest and most conspicuous players on the field of history are playing a different game. War games, self games, money games, board games, baseball games, church games, games ranging from lethal to trivial, sin and death games. But the Christian faith makes the bold claim that there is only one game on the field of history, and that is salvation. But it takes some doing for us to see that. It took some doing for Israel to see it. But see it they did, and here is how it came about. It happened in approximately 1250 BC. The people of Israel had been slaves in Egypt for over 400 years. Egypt dominated the world landscape, a totalitarian society ruled by a dictator who everyone believed was also a god. The splendor surrounding the dictator god made it believable. Breathtaking architecture, dazzling art, everything magnificent in gold. But the splendor was all on the outside. Inside, the place was crawling with maggots. Abuse, cruelty, superstition, degradation. And the Hebrews are right there in the middle of it all, but obviously and hopelessly on the losing side. Against such odds and under these conditions, it is difficult to apprehend God doing anything, let alone salvation. Not only the Egyptians were against them, the gods were against them. But there was more in the act of salvation than getting the Hebrews out of Egypt. Their perceptions had to be cleansed. If they left Egypt without a cleansed imagination, they would certainly reproduce the Egyptian way of life themselves. They had to have the veneer of Egyptian power and majesty and beauty and success ripped off and exposed as evil and silliness, the emptiness of evil. Their minds needed purging of every God illusion and God pretension. And this is where the 10 plagues come in. Each of the 10 plagues was an ammonia-laced scrub bucket of suds for just such a cleansing. The 10 plagues exposed the unreality of Egypt, the untruth of Egypt. The 10 plagues develop out of the confrontation between Moses and Pharaoh. And what is at issue is sovereignty. The confrontation lasted for 8 months. Think of it as the whole country turned into an arena packed with spectators watching two boxers going at it. Egyptians and Hebrews alike watch every move. The stakes are high. Two ways of life are at stake. 10 times Moses and Pharaoh go at each other. The first 2 rounds end in a draw. Each time after that, Moses wins. The overall significance of the plagues is that each plague has to do with some aspect of creation, a part of the way things worked in the natural, ordinary course of everyday life with which everybody was familiar. Everyone, of course, knew that Pharaoh was in charge of them all, in charge of keeping the cosmic order. That's what a Pharaoh did. That was his job description. So Pharaoh and Moses repeatedly go head to head. One after another, the life forms and forces over which everyone had always assumed Pharaoh was sovereign turn out to be at Moses' beck and call, not Pharaoh's. Everyone in the arena, it's a full house, the entire population packed in, sees that Pharaoh is completely out of control. Each successive plague displays its humiliating impotence on a large screen. Moses, prophet of Yahweh, launches and then banishes each plague. Pharaoh's vaunted sovereignty is systematically dismantled. The grandiose, elaborately maintained fraud that Pharaoh controls the behind-the-scenes workings of the world is exposed as a lie. Moses makes a monkey out of Pharaoh. Each plague exposed the pretensions of Egyptian sovereignty, blow by blow. The match got off to a somewhat slow start. The first 2, blood and frogs, are matched by Pharaoh's magicians, a standoff. By the 3rd, the mosquito plague, the magicians were clearly out of their depth. No match, no longer able to match Moses blow for blow. And after the sixth, the boils plague, the magicians were not only bested, they were incapacitated, put out of action by the boils. We hear no more of them. The four final plagues, concluding with the death plague, settle the sovereignty issue. Pharaoh is skunked. As the story is told, there's a kind of a slapstick cartoon quality as each Moses punch and Pharaoh's reeling. Blood, pow, frogs, pow, mosquitoes, pow, flies, pow, pestilence, pow, boils, pow, hail, pow, locusts, pow, darkness, pow, and death, pow. Each blow further loosened the hold on that immense world-dominating world of lies on the people until there was nothing left but a pile of rubble, garbage, and corpses. The contest in 10 rounds played to a packed house for a little over 8 months. And then, with their imagination cleansed of the demonic lies represented by the 10 areas of Pharaoh sovereignty, the Hebrews marched out of Egypt into the country of salvation, free to worship the God who saved. Jesus, in his temple cleansing, compressed the eighth-month drama of the 10 plagues' sovereignty into a work of a single day. Each of the gospel writers, aware of this Exodus background, remember, gives the cleansing a prominent place in their narration. John early in Jesus' ministry as a whole, the three others early in Holy Week. The last week of Jesus' life, the prophet like Moses, remember, was about to complete the work of salvation, bringing it out into the open where everyone could see it take place. Like Moses, Jesus also worked in an Egyptian-like setting. The Jerusalem temple, a godless place, extravagantly conceived and ingeniously constructed by the godless King Herod, and presided over by the equally godless Caiaphas, a place where the sovereignty of God was obscured beyond recognition. It was a site of enormous corruption and oppression, religion there being used to oppress the weak and the poor, much as had been done in Egypt. The oppression was especially evident at Passover, the great feast initiated under Moses in Exodus. During the week of the feast, the elite priestly class, the Sadducees, led by their high priest Caiaphas, gouged immense amounts of money from pilgrims arriving at the feast from all over the world, just as back in Egypt 1,200 years earlier, gold and power and magnificence dominated people's imagination at the precise time and place in which salvation was up for grabs. Jesus challenged the Caiaphas Sadducee sovereignty by confronting, humiliating, and banishing the den of robbers. The leaders rightly interpreted Jesus' actions as a sovereignty issue. By what authority are you doing these things? Who here would prove sovereign? Rich Caiaphas or poor Jesus? Jesus stood in the temple court, a lone figure, a Moses-like figure, dwarfed by wealth and power. How was Jesus, poor himself, without priestly and temple sanctions, to be seen for what he was, the architect of salvation? He needed to clear the deck so that he could be seen as himself in contrast to the showy Egyptian fraudulence. So he cleansed the temple, drove out the oppressors and the imposters, upset the routines, accepted practices of a successful, godless religion, spoke the words that established the sovereignty of God in that place in place of his own pure person. In the act of cleansing the temple, Jesus cleansed the people's understanding, purged their imaginations, and exorcism, so that the people, clear-eyed on the matter of God's sovereign authority, would be able to perceive and embrace salvation without distraction, without clutter. We catch a clear echo of the 10 Egyptian plagues and the temple cleansing. And so we're left now with a clear, radical new way of participating in history. It is impossible to exaggerate the historical significance and the endless personal ramifications of salvation. It always exceeds our powers of understanding and imagining. We will never get our minds around it. We see well enough what's going on. Christ is at work in history. He heals and helps. He forgives and blesses. He takes a creation of ruins because of human willfulness and patiently begins to make a new creation of it. He takes a world corrupted by evil and begins the long, slow work of transforming it into a holy place. We see all this in bits and pieces, moments and fragments. It is understandable that we often reduce salvation to a handful of themes, moments, or fragments, but we must not do that. We're dealing with Christ's work in history on a scale of comprehensiveness and generosity that ever eludes us. St. Paul, wrapping up his excursus on God's salvation work in history in his letter to the Romans, is appropriately in awe of what we will never grasp. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. I have one more thing to say about our participation in this. The triggering event in the Egyptian salvation story was a meal, a Passover meal. And the triggering event in the Jesus salvation story is also a meal, remembering Jesus' death. This is so characteristic of Christian spirituality. The ordinary and the miraculous are on a single continuum. Anything and everything that we believe about God gets grounded in what we do in the course of any and every day, ordinary day. We are not permitted to segregate salvation away from the details of getting around and making a living. The Christian church from its very beginning has used the Lord's Supper, this Holy Supper, to define our act of worship. It has also used our common meals as a link to our common worship. Worship, our focused participation in this gift of salvation, has its origin in a meal. At the Holy Supper, we take our places in the wildly generous world of salvation, lavish with grace. We will participate in that salvation by receiving the sacrificed life of Jesus and the bread and wine, remembering and proclaiming the Lord's death until he comes. We leave the table. Where do we go to begin our daily part in this remembering and proclamation? Well, we go home where our relationships are thickest and most textured, with the people we have most access, and among the responsibilities that define our obedience. We join in the preparing, serving, and eating of meals with family and friends, neighbors and strangers, in breakfasts of cornflakes and toast, lunches of bologna sandwiches, and suppers of tuna casserole. Every meal, breakfast, lunch, and supper, whatever the menu, wherever and with whomever we eat it, puts us in the company of Jesus, who ate meals with sinners and gave himself for us. Amen.